Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
There are days like today where I am just too busy to get outside and go feed myself. And that's where DoorDash comes in. It's super convenient, and they bring the food to me. Also, I don't like paying delivery fees, so I have DashPass. DashPass is an exclusive membership from DoorDash that gets you unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders and members-only deals and discounts, all for only $9.99 a month. DashPass actually pays for itself in 2 orders on average. DashPass makes it easy to save at restaurants, grocery stores, and all your local favorites. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today only on DoorDash and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply.
What happened? First, a car fire at the construction site. One unit responded, noticed a fire in an adjacent building, called for backup. A couple of more units came. As they were fighting that fire, there was a tremendous explosion.
This is a major construction site. They're building the Crosstown Expressway up here, and all kinds of equipment, all kinds of explosives.
So. Because they know it was a crime. They smelled arson from the very beginning.
The police have my statement. I'm talking to you right now. I'm letting the system take care of it.
We always felt they did a great job investigating this.
Additional people, other than the 5 people in prison, were also responsible for the crime, according to our investigation, but were never prosecuted.
This is one of the biggest, longest unsolved crimes in Kansas City.
Welcome to the third episode in our Kansas City Firefighters case series. On this installment, we sit down with Pat O'Connor. He was the publisher and editor of the Kansas City New Times and currently runs crimemagazine.com as well as kcfirefighterscase.com. Pat was the first outsider who took an interest in the case and has done extensive investigation into it. And on this episode, he will point out many issues with the investigation, misapplication of the law, and prosecutorial misconduct during the trial that he feels is responsible for why this case has gone the way it has. The accused and convicted, commonly referred to as the Marlboro Five, are Frank Shepard, Earl Skip Shepard, Brian Shepard, Darlene Edwards, and Richard Brown. They all came from the Marlboro District in Kansas City. They were charged with 6 counts of murder and sentenced to life in February of 1997 for the explosion that happened in Kansas City that took the lives of 6 firefighters. Other key players that you'll hear about are ATF agent Dave True, Judge Joe Stevens, Judge Fernando Gaitan, Robert Riggs, who was supervisor of Armor Guard Security, and his sister Debbie Riggs, who was on duty that night as a guard. Welcome, Pat. Why, in your opinion, did it take so long for there to be real progress in this case? And what was done to change that?
This case had gone unsolved for 6 years as the federal government, the ATF, and the U.S. Department of Labor had focused their investigation on organized crime, thinking that this humongous explosion was the work of organized labor as a retaliatory action for the construction site using non-union concrete. Ready Mix was the supplier. And they had non-union drivers of the concrete bringing it over to the site. So that this, they just got this in their mind that this was the theory behind the case, that this is union, this is a union job. So they do that for 6 years, and that leads nowhere. There was no union strife, any real strife at the site. There'd been one act of vandalism at that site, and it had it opened on Labor Day of 88, and there'd been one act, and it was known to be a disgruntled employee, a union employee, of one of Brown's brothers, the main contractor. And so this is how Robert Riggs, who ended up being one of the guards there at the site, this is how they first met him. They brought him on to tail this guy to see, you know, as they're trying to find out, trap this guy or catch this guy doing another act of sabotage. But he didn't. that didn't happen, but it was the only act in the leading up to, you know, Labor Day is in, you know, early September, and then we've got the explosion in late November. So for 3 months or so, there was this one act of vandalism, and there is never anything stolen from this site. Not before the explosion or the night of the explosion, nothing was stolen. Agent True, now, he's in his early 50s. He's been offered a job as head of security at Yellow Freight, which is a major New York Stock Exchange listed company headquartered in Kansas City. He didn't want to leave the ATF with the biggest case of his life unsolved. He was desperate to wind this thing down. He did two things to kind of give this thing to accelerate the development that where it ended up in Marlboro. He had this production company, Unsolved Mysteries, this TV program. He enticed them to come out and do a reenactment of the case, and with Robert Stack, the old untouchable, as the narrator. On this show, they announced a $50,000 reward for information leading to the convictions of the people responsible for killing the firefighters. I've never seen this done anywhere else. I've heard about it done in anywhere else. He had reward posters posted in every jail and prison in Missouri and Kansas. Combination of the Unsolved Mysteries, and some of these posters were posted on the overpasses in Marlboro and in conspicuous places around the Marlboro neighborhood. These two events bring out maybe up to 100 calls to the TIPS hotline, people wanting, you know, to cash in on, you know, they now know something. You know, almost 30 of them are felons in prison or very recently out and have other charges pending against them. I mean, they're still in the maw of the justice system and need help. The federal government has this, it's called a Rule 35B, where it is allowed to, in exchange for testimony against someone else in a crime, to cut your sentence, a sentence reduction.
Yeah.
It's a quid pro quo. You help us, even if you have to perjure yourself to do it, and we'll help you. Federal prisoners are particularly vulnerable or susceptible to this type of an offer because there's no parole in the federal system. So the only way out is to serve your time or to do a 35B, rat somebody out. And so a lot of people came forward on hoping for the 35B. I mean, they'd call their lawyer and say, see what you can work out. I heard admissions by one of these five, depending on what prison they were in. You know, Frank was in a certain place, Skip was in another, Darlene was in another, Brian was in. Richard Brown was the only one not incarcerated. And so he didn't get the jailhouse snitches, he just got the Marlboro snitches. Richard had no felony convictions on his record, and Brian only had one. And that was one that they set up as part of this big package to get the Marlboro Five in prison at that time. They had an undercover narc. Brian sold a very small amount of drugs to an undercover narc that normally you would have gotten probation. You would have gotten drug treatment program. That would have been the sentence for a first-time offender. But he got think he got 2 7-year sentences out of it. I mean, they really wanted him put away. You know, Dave True shows up at the courtroom and says, let's hit him with all we got. It encourages the judge, this is a very dangerous guy. He's out threatening people in the firefighter's case, and let's put him away. And they did. They put him away. No, and that was a claim that True, every time one of these guys got arrested, like when Skip got arrested, True would go to court and ask for no bail. And one of the judges asks, okay, what witnesses has he been threatening? You know, name them. True couldn't name any. There weren't any. Skip hadn't threatened anybody. But he used that ploy as a way to deny these people bail and keep them locked up. And while they're locked up, now the mechanism kicks in. The snitch now have their opportunity. I'll give you just one example. A guy named John White, he was incarcerated with Skip. Skip got arrested on a gun charge. He and two or three other people broke into a house in Kansas, stole like a shotgun and a rifle, that kind of thing, and brought it across state, you know, brought it back to Missouri, so that's a federal crime. So Skip's in correctional center and called Ozark Correctional Center, and here he meets John White. Or actually, John White meets him because John White knows the game. He has to have some contact with Skip to make up this deal. So he walks up to Skip and he asks Skip, does he have a match? And Skip had a match and gives the guy a match. He may have spent 2 minutes with Skip the entire time that they were incarcerated together. And John White had called his mother and had his mother send him all the back articles on the firefighter's case from the Kansas City Star. So from that, he fashioned quite an elaborate tale about what Skip's role in this case was and the things that Skip had stolen. He said that one of the things that Skip stole was a transit. It's an optical device they use at construction sites to tell grading and heights. And they don't even have one of those at this site. And John White went on and on. And he was the only of all the witnesses at trial, he was the only one with a college degree. He was pretty convincing, and he had all these items that Skip had stolen at that night, and nothing was ever stolen that night. I mean, nothing was ever stolen at any time at that construction site, according to the people who ran the construction site. So that would be an example of how this, you know, once they get you behind bars, this is now what is set in motion is this whole, subterranean witness manufacturing against your target. John White got his sentence cut by half. One guy named Glenn Shepard, and it's a different spelling, no relation to these defendants. He only has one P in his name. Glenn Shepard had 17 felony convictions. He was looking at it, and as a habitual criminal, he was looking at a sentence of 25 years for the last thing he'd done. True offered him, first that Shepard said he didn't know anything about the case. They wanted him to testify at the grand jury. And he said, I can't testify at the grand jury. I don't know anything about the case. And they say, well, we're going to upgrade. There was a gun charge against him in Blue Springs. So we're going to upgrade that Blue Springs gun charge to a federal charge, which a lot more time involved in it, if you don't tell us what you know about the firefighter's case. And he said, I still don't know anything, but he got the picture. He comes up with a story that implicates Frank, and he testifies at the grand jury and at the trial. And his sentence, instead of 25 years, is 1 year. And on cross-examination, he said, the fact is, if I was not testifying in this trial today, I would be instead serving a 25-year sentence. And now I've got a 1 year sentence. That's a pretty good deal.
How many witnesses were coerced this way?
A couple more examples of that kind of coercion where the guy first says, I don't know anything about the case. There was a guy named Travis Small. He was in prison in Arizona, and the ATF thought he knew something about it. He was a Marlboro guy, and they thought he knew something about it. So they sent an ATF agent down to interview him in Arizona, and he says, I don't even know any Shepherds. I've heard of Skip Shepherd, but I've never met a single Shepherd. A little while later, he has a charge levied against him in the Western District of Missouri here in Kansas City. They leveled a charge against him for a major drug operation for transporting cocaine, and not only against him, but his wife, too. this charge carried a sentence of 5 to 40 years, and his wife was in on two of the counts and a fine of $250,000. He gets the picture. Now he knows some stuff about one of these defendants. You know, he gets an attorney. Attorney goes to see Becker, and they work out this deal. All the charges against his wife are dropped. He gets a recommendation of a downward departure. Now, remember, I said 40 years, 5 to 40 years he could have gotten for this deal. He gets a downward departure recommendation of, I think, 7 to 11 years. I mean, he has done a very serious crime. And I think the fine goes away. There's no fine anymore. So that was the case. They squeezed him. He didn't know anything, but they squeezed him, and he comes up with, accusations against one of the defendants. The key government witness at the grand jury was Darlene Edwards' stepson named Ronnie Edwards, a young kid, 21, 22, but an inveterate liar, scam artist, fraudster, fake checks, that kind of thing, a scam guy. When he was much younger, he was like 16 when this thing happened, and he was talking about it. He talked about it so much that police came to see him, pulled him out of school and talked to him. He said stuff about Richard Brown and Chuck Jennings, Brian's best friends, Chuck Jennings. He said stuff about them. And then the years go by. Ronnie gets in trouble on another fraud deal, which violates his parole. And so True goes to see him and asks him to wear a wire and make drug buys for Darlene. That's how Darlene ends up. Ronnie comes over and says, my wife's divorcing me, and they're going to take the child away. He had a small boy. They're going to take him away if I don't get money right away. And so I need you to go to a dealer and buy some, cocaine, and so I can sell it and make a profit and be able to have enough money to hire a lawyer to fight losing my son. And Darlene said she would hire him a lawyer. Darlene had to come into a settlement. She was on a motorcycle with Richard Brown's brother, and somebody pulled out in front of him and ended up Darlene broke her back. So she had like $28,000 that she got out of this settlement. And at that time, she could have helped Ronnie right there. But he said, no, I really want to do it tonight. I need it tonight, and I need to get this done. So she goes out and buys the drugs. Ronnie driving the car, he pulls over in a 7-Eleven that's within 100 or 200 feet of a school, of a public elementary school, which very much ups the penalty for Darlene. Doing drug transaction within sight of a school, so she gets nailed on that. Ronnie, he becomes the star witness at the grand jury because he makes up this story that walkie-talkies, that Richard and Brian had these walkie-talkies they'd stolen from the construction site previously, and he was going to buy them from him.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles, and immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
The night of the explosion, Ronnie's back in this same bar, and he's asking Richard and Brian, and Darlene's in the bar, and Frank's out in the car, so he's kind of getting them all there. No Skip, but he's got four of them around this bar, and he's asking them to... If he and Alan Beth are in the bar, and Ronnie's asking them, can they get any more of these walkie-talkies? And they say, yeah, we can get some tonight. This is like 2:15 in the morning. The explosion will go off at 4:07. So Ronnie puts them all right there at that night at the bar. He and Alan drive down to the Quick Trip, and they see, after the first explosion, they see Darlene driving Brian's car. I mean, this is so far-fetched. It's unbelievable that Brian would let Darlene drive his car 90 miles an hour with Frank in the front seat and Brian and Richard in the back and somebody else he couldn't quite identify. So that's his story to the grand jury.
So the one piece of physical evidence that was alleged to be stolen from the site, the walkie-talkies, could not be tied to the scene or crime at all.
Those walkie-talkies that we're talking about were stolen by Alan Beathard from another construction site about 30 days before this explosion. They had nothing to do with Brian and Richard. They'd never stolen walkie-talkies. These were Alan Beathard's walkie-talkies. They wanted Alan Beathard to corroborate what Ronnie Edwards had said about everything. And Alan, he said, I can't vouch for anything that Ronnie said because everything he's told you that you've just told me is not true. It didn't happen. So those were my walkie-talkies. I never talked to Brian and Richard about stealing, and I sure wasn't with them the night before and all this, and I can't do anything to support what Ronnie's saying. Ronnie's lying. So True says, well, there's a gun charge pending against you in the state, but you took it across state line. We're going to make it a federal charge. And that's going to make your sentence much more severe. And he said, "Well, I'm still not going to corroborate anything Ronnie said." So they take him to federal district court on this gun charge, interstate gun charge. And they appear before federal judge Scott Wright. And Alan Beathard's attorney says, "Judge, my client here, they wanted him to perjure himself on another case, this firefighter's case. He refused to do it. That's why they're prosecuting him. This is a prosecution and retaliation." And Judge Wright said he was disgusted. He couldn't believe the government would stoop to that level. Called it in court a vindictive prosecution and gave Beathard, he gave him a downward departure. The judge gives him a downward departure and said, and there's no time, and he didn't give him any sentence at all. He said, pay for the truck that you took across, that you stole and didn't give back. Make restitution for the truck, and you get a couple of years probation. But that was the only time that anybody that I know of stood up to the pressure, the coercion that Dave True and Paul Becker were willing to apply to these people to get them to testify against these five people. Paul Becker was the assistant U.S. attorney who prosecuted the case for the government. To me, the most obvious suspects in this case were the guards at the site. They had the most to gain, and both of them individually had different things to gain, but they both had something to gain. That day at 3 o'clock, this is November 28th, the day before, you know, the explosions on the morning of the 29th, this construction company called up Robert Riggs, who's the president of AmeriGuard and runs this little mom-and-pop company, says, we're cutting your hours back by an hour on each end. they had two shifts of guards. One would come in at 6 and work till midnight, and the other would work midnight to 6. I guess that was like a 12-hour deal, so they're cutting it back to 10. So the first shift was Donna Costanza, who was Debbie's roommate. They were partners. Partners in the sense of we speak of today, you know, that people are partners. They lived together. And Donna had the first shift with a guard named Kevin Lemansky. And at some point, like at 8 o'clock that night, Donna's noticed that her cigarette lighter didn't work in her. She had a VW Rabbit, I think it was. Didn't work, and Lemansky tried to fix it for her. And when he did, he shot the whole electrical system out of the car so it wouldn't even start. Well, Donna's quite peeved. And then Donna calls up Debbie and says, you know, I got to get towed out of here now. This guy, this idiot's, you know, fouled up my car so bad. And so Debbie comes in early, but she calls her brother and says, you know, I'm going over there now. Why don't you meet me there? Because this is kind of screwed up. And then Robert does come over and he goes, makes a phone call, and he's the one that kind of gets the tow truck for. So they're working on this. They're working on this deal. And Robert must be, somebody's mad at Lemansky. They send him home, and they call in another guard named Melvin Stanton. They call him up at, he reports at like at 10. And the oddest thing happens, at 11 o'clock, they tell Stanton was on the east side where the Anfo trailers are sitting, and Debbie was on the west side where the big equipment is on this flat way down below. After an hour, Stan's only there an hour, and they call him up and tell him to go home. Robert Riggs. He said, go home. You know, you're done for tonight. I mean, he calls him in for this 1 hour. Debbie's driving a little pickup truck that a gas gauge is broken. It's got a lot of miles on it. It's paid for, and she wants to get some, what I think, she wants to get another vehicle. So Robert's got the problem with the hours being cut. She's got a problem with her truck. She has what I think most probably happened was they set her pickup truck on fire as a way of getting rid of the pickup truck for her benefit. And then to make it convincing, they went over to the east side and set a pickup truck. There was one pickup truck on the east side that was pretty close to within 3, 4, 5 feet of the, parked at the back of one of these Anfo trailers. That got set on fire too. So you got kind of a plausible story now. We've got vandalism at the site. They weren't doing it. You know, I mean, this isn't a self-inflicted job. This isn't a insurance scam because there's another truck on fire on the other side. But the problem was this truck was too close to the Anfo trailers, and they doused it with too much gasoline, and it got out of control, and it got to the trailer, and then an hour later, it explodes. It just, so the, what in my mind, and this, you know, my theory of this case is what started out as a petty insurance scam by the guard, in cahoots here, one wanting to keep the hours and the other wanting to get rid of a truck, ends up in this tragedy of an explosion that kills 6 firefighters. You know, that's my theory of what went on there. Debbie went home after the second explosion. She went to her mother's house in Grandview. Instead of staying around, they asked her to stay around and talk to the cops, but she went home. So Detective Zen went to her mother's house about 6 in the morning and picked her up. You know, the second explosion is like at 4:40, so she wasn't home very long, and Zen has her in a car going downtown. And he does a 40-minute videotape interview of Debbie in which she tells lie after lie to Zen about what happened that night. For example, she says, I wasn't supposed to work that night. She was scheduled to work that night at midnight. So I was only came down to that site to bring my brother a meatloaf sandwich. Not scheduled. My brother was on the east side. Their big cover story was they saw two prowlers. Debbie's sitting there by herself in her pickup truck, and she sees two large, darkly dressed prowlers about a quarter of a mile away near the office trailers that these people worked out of these trailers, office trailers, not Anvil trailers. These are on the west side, near the large equipment where Brown's brothers worked the operation from. And then so she calls on the, this is the story she's telling Zen, that she calls up her brother on a walkie-talkie or whatever they use, radio, and tells him about the prowlers, and he comes over, and then they go looking for him. They don't find them. And by golly, they decide they'll go down and ask the manager at the Quick Trip if he's seen anybody suspicious. And he tells them they haven't. Well, you'd think they'd get back in their car and back to the site. Their job is to guard this site, both sides. Sitting on the west side doesn't do anything for the east side because you can't even see up to it. It's 35 feet above, and it's dark on the east side. The west side is where the big equipment is very brightly lit, these two overhead lights. Anybody driving by can see anything going on there. But on the east side, it's just the opposite. It's in darkness. So you really need a guard up there on the east side more than you do the west. Could do a lot more on the east side in terms of not being detected. It's an easier side to breach. Yeah, they go off in his station wagon, and they go off to do this, but they don't just ask. I mean, they ask the guy, and he tells them, no, well, you'd think they'd come back to the site, but they don't. She buys breakfast rolls, puts them in a microwave to heat them up, buys milk. He gets a coffee. They're sitting outside in the station wagon having this snack when a woman named Vivian Rhodes, it turns out, comes driving in very rapidly into the parking lot, gets out of the car so fast that her door doesn't even close, and it's 38 degrees that night, runs into the Quick Trip and says to the manager, there's equipment on fire at the construction site. He doesn't call 911. He just comes out and tells the guards. And when the guards don't move fast enough to suit this woman, she gets back in her car, you know, like a good citizen, drives back on 71 and hails down a paddy wagon and reports the fire because she thought the guards were so unconcerned. So when the guards do get back to the site, they do call the fire department. And Debbie and Roberts, while Roberts reporting the fire to the fire department, in the background on the tape, the dispatcher tape, you can hear a woman's voice saying, "Oh, the explosives are on fire, too." Well, from where she was, there was no way she could have known the explosives were on fire. There were a lot of things up there.
Could you not see that far, or was there something in the way?
Then when they quarry that rock out of that on the east side, that's what it was a rock quarry. When they quarry that limestone out, they knocked down a lot of trees. And there was like a football field length full of trees that was stacked as high as at one of the trailers. I mean, it was a massive amount of trees. That could have been on fire. A compressor could have been on fire. They could see it. The best they could see is just some flames coming up. But to say that those flames were coming from the trailer, she had no ability to. You'd have to know that to say it. Immediately made me think, well, I know you can't see that, so for her to say that, that's inside information that only. You'd have to have been there earlier that night to know that thing was on fire. So she's doing this 40-minute interview with Detective Zen. Zen doesn't know it at this time, but he's finding it harder and harder to believe her. Another cop is interviewing Robert Riggs in the next door room, and Robert Riggs is now saying, you know, he was on the west side with his sister at the time, and she's saying he's on the east side. So they're kind of doing this back and forth. Which one of you is telling the truth? And so Zen's growing more leery as the conversation goes on, and he's starting to think that this prowler theory doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So the next night he goes back out. He goes out and meets up with Debbie at the site and has her truck's gone. So she's sitting in the police car. And he has Debbie show exactly where she was sitting and then where these prowlers were. I've been there, and I couldn't tell you whether it was a quarter of a mile or a third of a mile, but it's quite a ways away from where she was sitting, where she claimed to see these prowlers. And it's dark. So Zen had another detective with him, Detective Fraze. So Zen said, we'll do a little experiment here. I'll go down this quarter of a mile and by River Road, and when I get in place, I'll radio you, and then I want you guys look over and see if you can see me. So he's in place, and the radio's made, and Fraze can't see him. So Zen's, he's in a tan trench coat. He starts waving it, and Zen's a big guy. He starts waving his arms, and Frey's can't see him. I've been to this same place. I mean, I was there around midnight, very dark. I couldn't tell you whether it was a truck, I mean, a pickup truck or a car going by. Debbie could tell you that the guy was wearing in black clothing with a hoodie and had long hair coming out of it. That's how well she could see. And I couldn't tell you if it was a pickup truck or a car or, you know, what it was. It just, I could see two headlights. That's period. So when Zen gets back in the car, remember that Debbie said she was sitting in the, she was sitting in her pickup with the dome light on because she was doing new scheduling. They had to reschedule everybody because of the hours had been cut that day. So the dome light's on. Well, Zen puts on the dome light, and now all he can see is his own face in the window. He can't see anything. In his mind, this is a big, fat lie. One of the bright ideas the homicide department had was, let's polygraph Robert Riggs. At that point in 1988, Robert Riggs had 8 years as a polygraph giver. I guess you call him a polygrapher. He administered polygraph tests to, you know, companies that wanted to see if somebody was, you know, if Floyd was truthful or something. They'd hire people like Riggs. He'd been doing it for 8 years. Well, he passes the police-administered polygraph. That kind of drops him from the radar, even though police don't really, I mean, they're not admissible in court, and police don't really, they don't really give polygraphs much credibility because people can beat them. You could be a pathologic liar and beat them. They couldn't polygraph Debbie because she was 5.5 months pregnant, and apparently that's dangerous to polygraph. You hook them up, you know, you're hooked up to these wires and things and might not be good for the baby. So she skated on the polygraph. They don't polygraph her. So they kind of fall by the wayside, although I've talked to the captain who led this investigation, his number one person, the sergeant who led this early investigation, and to former detective Victor Zen for many hours. All of them thought the wrong five people were in prison. They thought these five people were terrible people, and they would be in prison for some other thing right now. I mean, it's not like they're bent out of their minds because these wrong five people were convicted, but they're not the right people in the policeman's minds. And they are highly suspicious of the involvement of the guards, that they had the motive. After all, they're the only ones there. The other preposterous thing about Agent True's theory of this case was the guards are only gone by their claim 5 minutes, but let's say they're gone 15 minutes. Let's triple what they say. This ragtag group of ne'er-do-wells, drunks and druggies, and three of them in terrible physical condition. They somehow, according to Agent True, they arrive at this scene in up to four vehicles. Come in totally unseen. No one sees them come in. They wreak all this havoc. They set a compressor on fire. They set a pickup truck on fire on the east side, and then they light this Anfo trailer. They get it going. While they're doing that, one or more of them goes all the way over to the west side and douses Debbie Riggs's pickup truck with gasoline. You know, why anybody want to do that, who God only knows. But, and then they all five leave unseen by anybody. Now, there's cars driving by here all night long. You know, not a lot of cars, but there are cars coming by all the damn time. So this ragtag group, they pulled off something that you would say the Navy SEALs or the Green Berets or somebody would have been very proud of accomplishing. Perfect ingress and egress to this site, you know, mission accomplished, and they're all home by the time the thing goes off. These guys committed a kind of a perfect crime, and they stole a lot of stuff while they were doing it. So that was, you know, it's farcical. The government's case against these five was farcical on many levels, but, you know, none more so than that they could have pulled off this incredibly efficient, dastardly activity in 5 to 15 minutes unseen. Yeah, you know, something else I think that points to the guards that never came up in any at the trial or anything like that. Debbie left in her pickup. she left her purse, her billfold, checkbook, that kind of thing, credit cards, and it was in like a little grocery bag. She used that as a to hold the billfold and stuff in. And she also left a .38 snub-nosed revolver in the truck that belonged to her brother, Robert Riggs. Now, I don't know very many women. In fact, I don't know any who would go off and leave their purse. And if I had just seen two prowlers, who would go off and leave the gun? So to me, it suggests like this is a panic operation. This pickup truck got on fire too damn fast. It wasn't time to get to go back in the back seat and or get these items out of there. We had to get out of Dodge. That Quick Trip thing was a really important part of their alibi. I mean, to be seen by this manager at a certain time, 37 minutes before the explosion, that was part of their alibi that was very successful for them.
It seems like that fire would have had to burn a lot longer than the 5 minutes they were gone.
That fire was, it wasn't just, you know, like a little fire in the truck. This truck was ablaze. The flames shooting up 10 feet out of this truck. There was so much gasoline poured on Debbie's truck. A few years before this, Debbie Riggs had arranged for her roommate, and by the way, I think it was the same one, Donna Costanza, to steal her car, have her car reported stolen to collect insurance, which she did collect on. She admitted this, she confided this to Paul Becker, the prosecutor, before she took the witness stand. Oh, by the way, a few years back, I had another incident with a vehicle of mine. It was a scam job. Getting rid of vehicles for insurance money was not a new subject to Debbie Riggs.
How on earth does law enforcement not go after a person who has a history of insurance fraud, whose truck happens to get burned in an arson?
Feds are the ones that ended up with this case. If this would have stayed a local Kansas City Homicide Department case, I think we would have had a totally different result. I think the guards would have been indicted. Because things kept happening to implicate the guards as the years went by. There was a woman that came forward in 1990, and this is the year, just a little over a year after the deal, after the explosion. She was a passerby, very credible person. She was taking a child to Research Hospital emergency room around, I think she took him over there about 2, and she's coming back around 3:30-something. As she's driving by the site, she sees Debbie Riggs. She didn't know it's Debbie Riggs, but she sees this pickup truck on fire, ablaze. She's the one to use the term ablaze, just burning like crazy. But she also sees two vehicles with headlights, like searching the area, like the bushes, not too far away from the truck. And these weren't headlights like you'd see on a police car. She said they were coming out of the sunroof. This is what the guards, Robert Riggs has had a sunroof in his station wagon. And so she sees this. This puts the guards at the scene when the pickup truck's on fire. Not at the Quick Trip. When they don't find out about it at the Quick Trip, they already know about it. So this woman gets home and calls 911 and reports what she's seen. And then when the explosion goes off, she calls the TIPS hotline and wants to make a bigger report. Because what she saw, she thinks is important. That these people who looked like, you know, not wannabe cops, but they had the looks of cops, who had these lights going on while this pickup truck's on fire before the explosion. Well, they don't call her back on the TIPS hotline, but it stays in her mind that this is important information that police should have. And so she has a friend who's a detective, a homicide detective, a woman detective. She calls her or sees her and says, "What should I do?" She said, "You should call homicide and make a report. Have them make a report about what you said." So this is 1990. Zen and Fraze are off the case now. It's been moved to other detectives. They've moved on. But Fraze answers the phone call. And he takes this report from this woman that basically relates what I just said. Well, you'd think this would have, like, really say, "Oh, hello, we're back in business with the guards." But it didn't have that impact. It gets signed off on by the sergeant, and then it's filed. And the government doesn't turn it over to the defense as they were compelled to do under the Brady rule. This is very exculpatory information about the Marlboro Five. I mean, it puts the guards at the site when the pickup truck's on fire. You couldn't get more exculpatory than that for the five defendants. But it doesn't get turned over. My opinion is if that report had been turned over, the guards would have been indicted, and the Marlboro Five would have never been heard of. Nobody have ever heard of them in this case. But the report got buried. So they had this, by this time they had a task force working on it. That's why Zinn and Fraze weren't anymore. They weren't on this task force that was now connected to the ATF and to U.S. Labor Department. A couple of from homicide, but not these two original guys, which wasn't very smart of them. I mean, why would you take the two guys that know the most off them? But they did.
Why weren't the guards pursued?
We were talking about some opportunities that kept coming up to bring these guards back into the focus. One such case was 1993. Now we're just, 4 years down the road or so. A ATF Special Agent True is informed that by a citizen named Johnny Ray Neal, that he'd overheard Donna Costanza, this is one of the guards at the site, telling the woman named Sandy DiGiovanni at Stack's restaurant on the north side. He heard Donna tell Sandy that she had assisted in a female security guard, Debbie Riggs, in setting fire to her pickup. So this guy goes to the ATF head agent and tells him this. You'd think this would be a pretty good tip. Over 8 months later, they finally send one of the people from the task force over to interview Debbie Riggs and confront her with this allegation that Donna had said that she helped her do it. This detective interviews her, and she says, that's not true. Donna's a drug addict. I haven't seen Donna in 2 months. Donna wouldn't have the guts to torch my truck.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to you. And Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. How can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
And the detective, his name was Emerson, he said, would you take a lie detector test? He said, oh, yeah, I'll take a lie detector test. This was on a Friday. That Monday, Emerson gets a call from a lawyer representing Debbie Riggs saying, she's my client. If you ever want to talk to her again, you talk to me, and she will never take a lie detector test. That's about their last really good clear shot at it. Now, what they could do, you can't just tell the government to pound salt. They could have taken this information to a grand jury or something like this. subpoenaed her in there and subpoenaed Donna Costanza, subpoenaed all these people in to flesh this thing out. They could have dug deep into this thing. They had a great chance that they didn't get the benefit of. They didn't take advantage of. Once again, it's this mindset that organized labor did it. Go away. Don't give me anything else. This isn't organized labor. So that just kept permeating this case. Was every chance they had it to get to the guards, they just didn't capitalize on it. When they finally gave up on labor and they went and did this unsolved mystery show and posted the $50,000 rewards, and then we get a whole new cast of characters comes in out of the Marlboro neighborhood as the most likely perpetrators. There were so many tips coming out of Marlboro. I read all the police reports that came in. There were dozens and dozens of people named as suspects in this case. Not one of these reports named Frank Shepard, Skip Shepard, Darlene, Brian, and Richard Brown. Not one report put these five together. Many, many reports introduced characters of, many other Marlboro residents were introduced at this time, sometimes in connection with one or more of these people. My point is that never these five were ever identified by anybody in this case, except for one witness at trial, Darlene Edwards' daughter.
Why did her own daughter turn against her?
True did his normal kind of high-pressure tactics to get, her name's Becky Edwards, to get Becky to be a prosecution witness. Becky was 11 years old at the time of the explosion. Her mother, I hate to say it, I'm ashamed to say it, did crack in the house. Frank did crack. Skip did crack. This little 11-year-old saw a lot of bad things. Mother get beaten up by Frank. Her brother moved to another state to get away from Frank, leaving her there. So she's had a very tough time. And in True comes to interview her. Becky had like a marijuana roach in the ashtray. When he sees that, he's basically got Becky right now. She could go to jail for, this could be a drug bust right here on her first interview she ever gave Dave True. And he lets her know that. He tells Becky things like, people know your mother's involved in this and she might get killed. It's better if she'd be in prison. It would be good for you to rat her out. Becky would very much like to get rid of this guy. And he's the kind of guy that doesn't go away until you give him something. He'll just keep coming back. I don't care where you go. You go to your job site, he comes there. You move to another town in Missouri, he comes to that town in Missouri. He will not leave you alone. So she finally comes out and says something vaguely about these five, plus a couple of others. One of them was Ronnie Edwards and some other guy. I can't remember right now. Maybe Johnny. His name was Johnny Driver. So we got seven of them sitting around Darlene's kitchen table, kind of talking about places they might go to steal stuff. Maybe a construction site. No particular construction site, not the one at 87th, not the one at 87th Street. This group of ne'er-do-wells would sit around and occasionally talk about stealing stuff and maybe a construction site. And so that's what she's willing to tell True. Now he gets it down to where this was maybe a week before or maybe the night before. All the way up to, and it was this construction site. It wasn't just any construction site. And it could have been, let's just say it was the night before. That's what the jury will get to hear, that it's as close as the night before. So when the jury hears this, this is the most damning thing that they hear at the trial. My God, here's the daughter of one of the defendants putting them all together in this wicked plot to steal stuff from the construction site. And if you can't believe her, who could you believe? I mean, she's got every reason in the world not to rat out her own mother, although they don't realize that she has very good reasons why, she's had a very disappointing time with her mother and detests Frank Shepard. And the others are kind of like collateral damage that get picked up here. The Brian and Richard, this is, they never sat around any table with Frank and Skip, never in their lives. Not that he wouldn't steal something if he had a chance, but Richard didn't steal stuff. So to put Richard at this table is really, really a disfavor to him. That was the most damning thing I think that the jury heard.
So no connection between these folks? Where did it go south?
And Darlene and Richard really sunk this case. Right after the explosion, Darlene made a comment that got right back to the cops. Darlene's sister said the same thing, that right after the first explosion, there was a black truck, that, just like Richard Brown's, that goes shooting down Brooklyn. Right in front of, right by Darlene's house and her sister's house. These people all live very close together. And her sister said, "There goes Richard." And Darlene starts reporting this around Marlboro, and it gets right back to the cops. So the KC cops start harassing Richard right away. It doesn't take him long to figure out that Darlene's the source of this thing, even though they're good friends. But it's just, gossip was rife in Marlboro at this time, and it was the talk of the thing for years. You couldn't turn on the TV set for a long time, many months after this case, without hearing about the firefighters' case. So they're talking about it, and it brought notoriety. I mean, the cops come by. The cops came by and got picked up Darlene and Frank one night. They were on their way to a laundromat, and they pull them over right outside the laundromat, and they say to them, "You're under arrest for murder." Kansas City cops. And they take him down to the police station. They interview Darlene for like 3 or 4 damn hours. Frank falls in another room. Frank's in a room adjoining. He goes to sleep on the floor underneath a table. They spend like 10 minutes with him. When they're through with Darlene, they drive her back to her car at the laundromat. And they're done with Frank in 10 minutes. You know, it's now like 3 in the morning. This would be like 1989. Once this Agent True started focusing in on the Marlboro Five, they really stepped up the pressure on Richard Brown. They kept arresting him and interviewing him. They're allowed to hold you for like 72 hours without a charge. So they'd hold him for 72 hours, questioning him about this case, and then he'd walk out the door, they'd tackle him or handcuff him and bring him back in another 72 hours. Totally illegal, but that's what they did. And he refused to cooperate with him, and so Richard was notorious for driving without a license. He got his license suspended when he was like on his 17th birthday in Grandview, and so from then on he drove without a license, and he was often out racing the cops, you know, just driving a lot faster than they did and getting away from him. But every now and then he'd get nabbed, and he had a long list of traffic citations for driving without a license. So one time he's not even driving the car. His friend Chuck Jennings is, but the cop, they want him back downtown. Cop takes the keys out of the ignition, throws them at Richard's feet and says, "You're the driver. You're coming with me because you don't have a license." And this time they send him out to Leeds, detention farm outside of, you know, North Kansas City, north area of Kansas City. They really want him to say something. And so the first thing he says, he makes up some story about, he said they won't, you know, he makes up a story he thinks they won't believe, and he puts in like 6-7 people into this deal. Darlene, Frank, Skip, but a bunch of other people too. Their sister Diddy, whose name is Diddy, the Shepherd, Diddy Shepherd. Larry Baker, her husband. He puts in a bunch of these names. That's too many names for them. They bring him back in. And now they really want him to knock it, you know, narrow it down to the group they're interested in. He was at Quick Trip, and he saw them walking toward the construction site with a gas can. All right, so they typed that up in a statement. He thinks by not signing it that you can't attribute it to him, but he, you know, Richard doesn't know anything about that. So the day they bust Darlene on the drug charge, Dave True says, "You know, you've got a window of opportunity here. You tell us about the firefighters case, and this drug charge goes away like this. You're not looking at 10 years on this. You're looking at no years. Help us on this firefighters case." She said, "I can't help you. I don't know anything about it." And he said, "Well, you've got to 10 years. See, I've got to 10 years because I don't know anything." give me a polygraph. Polygraph me. I'll do it right now. No, we're not gonna give you a polygraph. We're gonna let you think about this some. And they put her in a room by herself, and they put Richard Brown's statement on the table. So she's reading that. Holy, she sees that Richard has implicated her, Frank, and Skip. And so she figures that if he can implicate her, she might as well implicate him. But she doesn't do it right away. She goes out, they put her out in the jail in Liberty. A couple of days, no shower, no phone calls, no nothing. About 9 o'clock, she calls up the ATF guy and says, I'm ready to talk. They do an audio recording. They read her Miranda rights. They offer to plea deals to these. We'll talk about that a little bit later. So Darlene's now says, I'm home asleep on November 28th, 29th, whatever it was. I can't remember the time of day, but she's home asleep when Richard and Brian wake her up, and they say they ran out of gas, and she take them to get some gas. So she drives into the Quick Trip. They fill up the gas can. They're bringing it back, and then Richard and Brian start talking about they're going to go up to the construction site and rob it. And they got this can of gas with them. So now we've got, this is on an audio tape, at trial this whole thing is played. So here's one of the defendants saying that she took two of the defendants there and dropped them off, and she had nothing further to do with it. Kind of, you know, gets herself off the hook, she thought, and put these two guys in the noose. I mean, the jury can now see these people are involved some way. All these snitches might be, you know, some of them, I mean, some of them, their stories are obviously crazy and unbelievable. But when one of the defendants is on an audio tape, they don't play the videotape of her where she says, I know nothing about this case, give me a polygraph. The jury doesn't get to see that. Defense says, let's play the videotape of where she doesn't. Judge says, no, can't have that. Jury can't see that. Attorneys go up to the bench and ask for these kind of things. You know, they can't just say it in the courtroom. There's a videotape where she says she knows nothing. You got to go up and whisper it to the judge. So the jury only gets to hear this. And so this possibility that these five, no matter how implausible the government's case was with all these jailhouse witnesses, Darlene herself saying that she has agency in this crime. When this case was rested, went to the jury, the jury asked for two things. They wanted to hear the audio tape of Darlene again, and they wanted to read Becky Edwards' testimony. They could hang something on that.
Did they testify?
None of these five testified at trial in their own defense. And there was this problem. You know, they were represented by five separate defense attorneys. All good defense attorneys, but they had conflicting interests. On the one side, you had Richard Brown. The other side, you had the other three. And by the way the indictment was read, printed, Richard Brown was last. If these five testified, Richard Brown could always go last. He was always entitled to be the last one. The other four were kind of afraid of him. Richard is kind of unpredictable, and his attorney is a bulldog, John Osgood, and he was 19 years as a federal prosecutor. And this was his first big case as a defense attorney, and he didn't have that cooperative spirit that you'd normally get among a group of defense attorneys. John Osgood thought, you know, his client had vested interests other than theirs, that he had separate interests. These were four high school dropouts, and Darlene, who graduated Center was the only high school grad there, and very unsophisticated about the judicial system and what you can do in court and what you can't do. And they were afraid of that they wouldn't be very good witnesses either, and on cross-examination, Becker could bring out, 19 rebuttal witnesses, he could try his whole case again. So there was some reasons for him not to testify. From what I can tell from talking to the attorneys was there was this fear that Richard might sandbag him at the end. But I don't know why they had that fear, because before the trial started, during the trial, and before the sentencing, the prosecutor approached these five attorneys individually and said, you turn state's evidence against the other four, 5 years, and you're done with this case. You're going to get life without parole otherwise. Well, all five of them turned it down three times. But Richard had his chance at the 5 years right there and didn't take it. End of the trial? Well, they weren't out, you know, they asked those two items, and the jury deliberation, the judge gave instructions, and I thought they were pretty clear, but the jury didn't find them clear. These five had to be individually either not guilty or guilty, one at a time. You can't just all five of them. Each one of them had to be considered. You could find one of them not guilty and the other four guilty, or four guilty and four not guilty and one guilty. It's up to you. You're the trier of fact. That's what the jury is. Well, they didn't understand that either. So the only vote they ever took, they took one vote, and they voted on all five of them, one fell swoop. There was sentiment in the jury room to acquit Darlene. I mean, after all she did was drop these guys off, according to her story, that the jury heard on the audio. I mean, the government sounded like it believed it. You listen to the audio, they don't say, "You're lying, Darlene. You didn't, you know, you stayed." So they wanted to acquit her and convict the other four, but they thought if they let her go, they'd have to let all the other four go, and they weren't about to do that. So they blew that. The jury blew these two basic instructions. These people, these five defendants, have never caught a break in this case. I mean, everything that could go wrong went wrong, and probably nothing more went wrong than the bad luck they had on the judge. The judge that handled all the pre-trial stuff was Federal District Judge Bartlett, who was considered probably the fairest judge in the Western District of Missouri. He agonizes over, you know, the meaning of a word. Every defense or prosecution objection, he gives serious, careful, belabored thought to. He's a very diligent judge. Morning of the trial, the jury had been picked. Bartlett was there when they picked the jury. But the day they came in to start the trial, make the opening statements, Bartlett's not there. He'd been diagnosed with bone cancer that would very soon kill him and had to leave the trial. Could not preside at the trial. And he was replaced by a judge named Joe Stevens on senior status, who had just the opposite attitude in the courtroom. He wanted it to be everything to move along at a smart pace. No agonizing over the meaning of words, and if you made an objection, forget it. Unless you happen to be the government, you could make an objection. Very pro-prosecutorial judge. He would make an objection before the prosecutor could make an objection. He would stop the defense attorney himself instead of waiting for an objection to come from the prosecutor. He'd just cut him off. Come here. Call him up to the bench. You can't go that way. I'll give you an example of how unfair this judge was. One of the attorneys is interviewing a government witness, and she mentions the fact that her investigator had interviewed this witness, and she's now going to say some of the things that he had told the investigator. And the judge stops her. No objection from the prosecutor. The judge stops the trial, calls her forward, they all come up, and the judge says, "I don't have any confidence in defense investigators. I will not allow any questioning based on information you have from a defense investigator, and I particularly don't like this defense investigator," who was a former, very well thought of Kansas City, Missouri cop. So the next day, the five defense attorneys cannot believe what they've heard. This judge has total disregard, discredits any as unworthy any of the work product of the investigators. So these five, they do agree on one thing. This judge has got to go. And they submit a request to the judge to recuse himself for bias. Well, this is one of these deals where either it works. If it's great, if it works, judge recuse himself. But if it doesn't work, it's like a suicide mission. Now you really got a problem. And the judge took 2 seconds to say he's not recusing himself and press on. He already was giving short shrift to the defense, but now, I mean, it was just another great example. The defense had built its real case around calling Debbie Riggs, Robert Riggs, and Dave True, the investigator, as defense witnesses. They thought there were so many lies that Debbie Riggs had told about her, what happened that night, and what Robert Riggs too. They could have gone and painted a new picture for the jury about what really went on that night. I mean, why would they go off, a group paid to be there and guard a site? How do you ever leave a site Maybe one of you goes, but you both don't go. All right, questions like that. And then all the lies that Debbie told that we now knew were lies, the defense now knew were lies, because Debbie had done a number of civil depositions. You know, there were millions of dollars of damage caused by these explosions, particularly the second one. And so there were class action suits by homeowners, business owners, and the insurance companies now had the right to depose people from Brown Brothers Construction, people from Mountain Plains, and AmeriGuard. These were the three people they were suing, the three groups they were suing. So Debbie Riggs had to go on, had to do deposition after deposition, very lengthy ones, hour-long, two-hour-long depositions, where a lot of the stuff that she'd told Zen, she had to now admit was a lie. And the people deposing her knew they were lies, so they couldn't wait to talk to her, to get Debbie Riggs on the stand, who happened to be the government's first witness in the case. And Robert Riggs was the second witness in the case. And they saved True for last. So anyway, these are very important government witnesses, and they were to be the most important defense witnesses. Somebody else did it is the greatest defense, most common defense you can come up with. I mean, that's the classic Perry Mason thing, you know. My client didn't do it. This guy did it. This guy's sitting in the third row here. The defense is predicated on that. So while Debbie testifies, and then now there's five. It's a very clumsy, awkward situation with five attorneys. Now the cross-examination begins. Well, they're kind of falling over themselves. They, you know, one after another, these defense would have different things they wanted to ask Debbie about. And at some, a lot of the points, the judge would say, that's cross-examination is limited to what the prosecution asked the witness and what the witness commented on. You can only go back over the ground that the prosecution is interested in. They had questions, and the judge would say, that's beyond the scope. You can't ask her that because that's beyond what the prosecutor asked her about. That's off limits right now. You'll have to wait to ask her that when she's your witness, okay? And the same kind of phenomenon went on with Robert Riggs. They couldn't go beyond the scope with him, and because they could call him later. And then Dave True, who was on the witness stand a long time, they didn't ask him anything about why he, you know, fashioned these five and why he did the, you know, why he did the, what's the motivation behind unsolved mysteries and why put these posters in all the jails, and they don't ask him that. Well, the defense wants to ask him stuff like that. Well, that's beyond the scope. So these are all set aside. The defense really only has these three guys. That's the centerpiece of it. The prosecution rests its case, and it's now the defense's turn. This is at the bench. The jury's not hearing this. The judge says, I'm giving this some thought. I'm not going to allow you to call Debbie Riggs, Robert Riggs, or Dave True, or Gene Schramm, the head guy for the U.S. Labor Department. And here's why on the first three, on the Riggses and True. You had ample opportunity on cross-examination to ask all the questions you wanted to. And Schramm, it would be unfair to the prosecution for you to be able to dig up all the stuff that the damn Labor Department found out. I mean, they found out a bunch of stuff, too. It wasn't all that unlikely that labor was involved. I mean, it's not implausible. In fact, it would be, considering, you know, Kansas City's labor history, you know, that was a time probably a lot of fruitful things popped out of this investigation. So there goes the defense. The defendants aren't going to testify. They just have a couple of alibi witnesses, and then they rest. It's a farce. The government prosecuted them for like 5.5 weeks. They have like 2 days, a day or two of alibi witnesses. You know, and you get Frank and Skip's mother up there. Well, that's Frank and Skip's mother. She'll say anything, you know. But all five of them.
What are the alibis for the five?
It's the alibis these five people had for that day. I mean, they were really strong alibis. I mean, they were accounted for by many, many people throughout the day, November 28th. You know, it was the weekend following Thanksgiving. And so that's the Monday. Most people are preparing to return to work or go to school. But Larry Baker, he's the brother-in-law of Frank and Skip, married to Diddy Baker. He thinks it's a great day to have a party at his house in Marlboro. Case after case of beer comes in, and people drop in and drop out all day. And Frank, he'd been run over by a car, so he limps up the street to get there. Skip's there, brings his girlfriend.
there's going to be a cookout at like at 6:30 or something like this. And people come and go. The Frank's parents come and go. Neighborhood people come and go. So they're seeing these people there. And Frank and Skip are drinking an enormous amount of beer. Frank estimated that day that he drank a case. At some point, Frank gets mad at Darlene and throws something at her, and at which point Darlene decides to leave about 5 o'clock. She's had enough of Frank for the day. She takes Becky. They go home. They putter around until Becky goes to bed, and then Darlene watches The Tonight Show. That's okay. That's Darlene. Frank and Skip and Skip's girlfriend are still there. They have the cookout about 6:30, eat, and then they just watch TV. It's cold that night. Frank is very badly injured from the car accident, and so Larry, about 1:30, says, Frank says, I'm leaving, and Larry says, you can't walk. They get a six-pack of beer. They're only going 2 blocks. They get a six-pack of beer, and Larry drives Frank to his house. In Marlboro, they don't have sidewalks per se. They have ditches. Frank gets out of the car and falls into the ditch. Larry has to call Darlene out of the house to help him lift Frank up. He's dead weight. Carry Frank into the house. Now, Frank's got mud on his shoes and his pants, and Frank's a very meticulous, one of these guys that always has pure white tennis shoes, very prides himself on the crease in his pants, I mean, this kind of thing. So this is bad news for Frank falling in a ditch. And then he comes in, and he tries to go to bed, but his stomach's too upset, and he asks Darlene to make him some scrambled eggs and to make a Pepto-Bismol cocktail for him. He says, I'm just about ready to smoke my last cigarette of the day when the first explosion goes off.
What were Richard and Brian doing the day of?
What's Richard and Brian doing? Well, they're doing what they do almost every day. They're 17, and Richard's barely 18 years old. They just drive around Marlboro looking for scrap metal. They like to find metal or copper and take it to a junkyard or somebody that deals in this kind of stuff and sell it for a little bit of money. They're trying to make enough money to buy beer or cigarettes. They get up about 11 o'clock, 11, 12, as they do every day. And they do this scrap metal deal. And Richard drops Brian off about 6:30. I know Richard has a pretty good recall on this day, though. It was dating a girl that worked at one of these topless bars. He picks her up. She has a friend who's babysitting somebody, so they go over there and wait for these people to come back about 11:30, so they play cards. Richard and these two young women are playing, some kind of card game. The woman comes home, they play cards, the four of them now, and at some point, this woman who works at the bar wants to go home and go to bed, and so Richard takes her to this motel, drops her off, and then the other woman comes with him, and Richard, by this time, is so drunk himself, he and the young woman go in his house, and he sleeps on the sofa. She sleeps in there someplace, too. So that's what this group of these five defendants, that's how they spent that day.
When we were outside, you talked about why you got involved in the case?
At the time of this trial, 1997, the trial of the Marlboro Five, I was the editor and publisher of an alternative weekly newspaper called the Kansas City New Times. J.J. Maloney had been a former editor of the New Times and had been an investigative reporter for the Kansas City Star prior to that, and also for the Orange County Register. He was the paralegal for one of the attorneys, who represented Darlene Edwards. His name is Will Bunch. And J.J. was a paralegal for him throughout this trial. At the end of it, he approached the publisher of of our paper and said he'd like to write an article about the case. We agreed. See what you do. Well, he did a beautiful job. He wrote a 10,000-word article about, we called it Frame Up, showed how these five got picked, how they got framed by this ATF agent to answer for this crime. And then part two was railroaded how Judge Joe Stevens made it possible for these five to get one of the most unfair trials imaginable. But it kind of stood in my craw that this massive injustice could be perpetrated, and these people being all indigent, nothing was ever going to happen to them. I mean, they were dead. You would have never heard their names again unless somebody did something. somebody had to take on this case. Somebody that stand up to this great injustice and see if you could do something about it. So I hired an attorney to do the habeas corpus petition. And he raised 21 claims about how unfair that trial was and many other things. Federal judge here, Fernando Gaitan, he didn't do anything on the habeas corpus for 2 years and then turned it down in a one-sentence denial, the whole petition. Then I went to see John Osgood to say, what could you do now? He said, well, now that you've lost that appeal, the only thing you can do is you have to get newly discovered evidence not previously available and bring that forward and ask for a second habeas corpus. And these are very rare. I mean, rare in the sense of like 2%? 2% of cases ever get a second chance of having a habeas corpus? So John thought that one of the best ways would be to go out and re-interview some of these witnesses, these trial witnesses. And so he had an investigator named Mark Reeder. This is the same investigator, by the way, that Judge Stevens said you didn't trust. Former police officer, I think he was a former sergeant, and a very good guy, straight shooter guy. So he and I, we went and we started going back and getting some of these trial witnesses. One of my special case was Becky Edwards, the daughter. I did a few others. We had these 8 affidavits, recantations. And they all kind of said the same thing, that this agent was very abusive and coercive. I mean, like, for example, one of them said that, and this is typical of the way Dave True operated, he would say to a witness, I know what you know, and if you don't tell me what I know you know, that's obstruction of justice, that's a federal crime, you're going away. And that 2-year-old son of yours, he's going to social services. Now tell me what I know you know.
That's a catch-22 for any witness if I've ever heard one.
And by the way, here's what I know you know. You were at a party and Marlboro, and you heard Brian and Richard make admissions along these lines. I mean, that's one of the affidavits. This woman's name, Carrie Neighbors, testified at the trial, had been a former girlfriend of Brian, as just one example. So I took these 8 affidavits down to Mike McGraw, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, whom I never met in my life, ask him to take a look at possibility of the Star getting involved in the case.
Yeah, we interviewed Mike on episode 24.
And he said, you know, he thought it was a long shot, but he'd get back to me. And 6 months later, the Star put him on the case full time. One story after the other started coming out. And, you know, you've interviewed Mike. He's done a fantastic job. And, you know, where Mark Reeder and I found 8 witnesses, Mike found 15 who said that they were agent coerced them. You know, not all of them agreed to lie, but the coercion was very substantial for them to lie. So Mike did this front page story about that, and that led to the then U.S. Attorney for the Western District, a guy named John Wood, to call for an independent investigation of this witness tampering. I mean, this looked terrible. The Representative Cleaver said, this is an outrage, you know, what this investigator did. Judge Wright, the one that stood up to Becker on the Allen Bethard case, he said it was an outrage, and it was. This led to it wasn't an independent investigation at all. It should have gone to the Inspector General's office. That's what Inspector General's offices are for inside. You know, all departments of government have this Inspector General function to keep them honest. They work independently of the rest of the department. Well, this didn't go to the Inspector General. It went right back to the Paul Becker side of the deal, the criminal division. They gave it to an attorney in Washington, D.C., the Department of Justice and the criminal division to investigate. Paul Becker and Dave True had greatly abused these witnesses because both of them had done it. I mean, Becker cut all these deals with these snitches. Becker's the one that took this lying perjury at the grand jury from Ronnie Edwards, you know, and this kind of thing. I mean, Becker's in this just as deeply as where Dave True maybe didn't make much sense. Paul Becker was just, he had the authority of the government. I mean, when, you know, in a courtroom or anywhere else, I mean, you represent the United States government, and he had all this credibility that he just abused. He just abused as much as he could to get these five to go down. You have to ask yourself, what's the motivation? Well, other than closing this case, I mean, you would think he would be motivated by justice, that that would be his number one job, is to get the right people and to close the case properly, but that wasn't it. They just picked these five ne'er-do-wells out whom they knew were defenseless. They wouldn't have the money to make any appeals. I think one of the most important stories Mike did was about this woodcutter at the site named Ed Massey. He confirmed something that I think really makes a lot of sense in terms of the whole timing of the explosions up there. The second trailer to explode exploded 40 minutes after the first one. And it was the second trailer was hit by this massive fireball that cut the trailer in half and set it up on end. I mean, it was so forceful. That's how hard it is to get Anvil to explode. Is, I mean, it hits a fireball and doesn't explode. It has to, and it starts burning. And it took 40 minutes for that, with that much force and heat, to explode. So I think it stands to reason that it took a lot more than 40 minutes without any fireball to get the first trailer to go off. So Ed Massey, he goes to the ATF all these years later, like 2008, when Mike's doing these stories. And he says, I was at the site the night, I was on the east side of the site that night, and I saw one of these guards, Donna Costanza, throw something on fire at the trailers. It was a flash. I saw Donna, and then I saw a flash. And then I saw Donna leave and go back to the west side. He also said, several times before the explosion, Debbie Riggs and Donna had approached him torching Debbie Riggs' truck. He said he'd give it some thought, and they came back later, and while he was still thinking about it, and they said, Debbie said, I've got, according to Ed Massey now, and this is a published article, I've got some additional items I'm going to put in the truck to get more insurance on. I can't remember what those items were, but it wasn't going to just be the truck. So Massey's telling this to, he told us, the ATF. ATF makes like a 3-page report. Becker is compelled, and this time he turns over this report about Massey to the defense. Darlene is now represented by another attorney. So this attorney and the Midwest Innocence Project, they get copies of this report. Massey is also goes to see Mike McGraw. By the way, Massey said this was 2:30 in the morning around. He'd been called up there on a kind of a dispute he was having with another woodcutter up there. He figured out 2:30, and finally it goes off at 4:07, the first trailer. So he sees this flash that Don is throwing at the trailer at 2:30, and then at 4:07 it finally goes off. So it's a lot more than 40 minutes, which I think it would have needed without the catalyst of a fireball. All right, so Massey goes to see Mike McGraw, and Mike finds him, you know, I mean, God, I mean, this guy, former criminal, you know, ex-convict, and Mike's leery of him. And so says, we can't do anything with this guy unless you let's give him a polygraph. So they polygraph him, and he passes it. And the Star is still cheery about this guy, and so they hire the number one polygraph expert that I've ever heard of is a guy named Charles Hontz, H-O-N-T-S. He's, I think, based out of Oregon. They fly him in to polygraph Ed Massey. Ed Massey passes again. What Ed said ties in pretty well with a few days, in the immediate aftermath of this explosion, the Kansas City Police Department set up blockades on north-south lanes of 71 going by this site to try to interview, to find people who may have driven by the site the night of the explosion to see what they had seen, if they could give them any information about what was actually going on that night. They've got, I don't know, 20 or more, maybe 20 or more people remembered going by that night and seeing certain things. For example, one thing several of the people saw was that the hood on Debbie Riggs's pickup truck was open, and the station wagon was parked the opposite direction. They were just side by side underneath these very bright lights, and it was like they were working on the engine. That was the impression that people got. And one of these people that got that impression was a mechanic. But three of these passerbys, let's call them passerbys, who told cops that sometime after 2 o'clock they saw a VW on the west side. Now, Donna Costanza had left in a tow truck with her VW around 9 o'clock because her car wouldn't start anymore in a VW. Now, three of these passerbys are seeing a VW again back at the site. One or more passerbys reported seeing two female guards standing outside of a station wagon. And while there are people in a station wagon, like two people are in a station wagon, so that's four people they're seeing there. The Riggses always said they were the only two there that night. Donna went off on the deal, and they told the other guy to go home, and then they brought in this other guard and only kept him an hour. Then it was just the two of them, him on the east side and her on the west. These passerbys are seeing up to four people, and they're seeing the VW back on the scene. So this kind of ties into me very much with what Ed Massey ends up reporting about seeing this Donna Costanza on the east side and a flash of going off toward the trailer. It very much fits together to me about what went on up there that night. Well, Brian Shepard, as I say, they scrapped for metal with Richard Brown. Richard remembers dropping him off about 6:30. Brian did that night. He doesn't remember, but he does remember coming home, and there are people there who remember it too. About 11:30, coming home so drunk he flops down on the sofa, tries to go to sleep, but his girlfriend, who is 5 months pregnant and sleeping downstairs, she comes up and joins him on the sofa. They talk for a while. Even though she's 5 months pregnant, she's not allowed to sleep in the same room with Brian, so she knows that she has to get out of there by 3. So when 3 o'clock rolls around and she sees it, she heads back downstairs, leaving Brian on the sofa. And then the next thing this woman knows is that she's being awakened and making everybody evacuate the neighborhoods. They're going door to door, they're worried about a third explosion, although I don't know why they're worried about that, but they're also about main lines breaking and gas explosions underground. And Brian's upstairs, still asleep at 7 o'clock or so when she comes up. The biggest development in the case, in 2012, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in a case called Miller versus Alabama that it was unconstitutional to sentence, to have mandatory sentencing of life without parole to minors. And since Brian was a minor at the time of the explosion, he was entitled to a resentencing hearing. And he was brought from, the government agreed, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed, he could get a new hearing. And Becker had no objection. So Brian was brought from federal penitentiary in Pine Knot, Kentucky, to the CCA in Leavenworth, a detention center run by, it's under the administration of the U.S. Marshals Service, run by the Correctional Corporation of America. So he's brought out there 9 months ago now. And the resentencing should have already happened, but one of the states, the reason the federal government didn't care very much about it was there's only 38 people in the federal system who were sentenced as juveniles to mandatory life without parole. But the states, there were 2,200. And the states did care. And one of the states, Louisiana, had 325 of these cases. These states used to love to try kids as adults. They loved it, for a lot of different kinds of crimes, but murder for sure. So Louisiana, they petitioned the Supreme Court saying that Miller wasn't retroactive. Supreme Court only meant for it to go forward, that these 2,200 people in state prisons, they stay exactly. Their status doesn't change. And only going forward, it was Louisiana prohibited from issuing mandatory life sentences without parole. Becker used that as a pretense, even though he'd already agreed to give Brian the resentencing. The Eighth Circuit had said he's entitled to it. No objection. Used that as a pretense to delay Brian's sentencing and say, well, let's see what the Supreme Court rules in this case, Louisiana versus Montgomery. The judge, Judge Guyton, the one who did the habeas corpus denial, he gave a stay pending the outcome of this case. Well, a couple of weeks ago, the Supreme Court ruled on this in kind of a hasty way. A lot faster than we thought, we thought they would. And they said it was retroactive. They had one great remedy for Louisiana, big concern about retrying 325 guys, parole them, no retrial. even though that decision's come down, we haven't, Judge Guyton hasn't issued a new date for the resentencing. So we don't know when that's going to be. We don't, I expect he'll set a date somewhere around, you know, I mean, somewhere in the spring. And then Becker or Brian's attorney will want more time. It seems like that always is the case. And then they'll give him a stay of 60 days, 30 days, 60 days. But sometime in 2016, I would expect for this resentencing to take place. And one of the things that's supposed to entitle the attorney for Brian is Cindy Short of the McAllister Law Firm. It's supposed to entitle her to discovery. For example, this DOJ report, we were talking about it. We never did finish when they appointed this attorney from the criminal division to do the investigation of. Well, when they issued the report saying that the agent had done nothing improper, they also said there were two other, unbeknownst to the investigators at the time, there were two other perpetrators. Names redacted. So if we could only know the names of those two people, whom I have a high suspicion are the two guards, or at least two of the guards. Well, I could be wrong about that. It could be two more people from Marlboro. But nonetheless, it would all come down if they know about these two people, what was their role in this? You know, we talk about mitigation. Maybe these two played the primary role in this. They won't tell us who they are. They have not called a grand jury to indict these two. And this is in 2011, this report came out. And now here we are 5 years down the road and nothing's happened to these two other people. Well, Cindy thinks she's entitled to know their names and to see the unredacted 20-page report that the government investigation from the DOJ published about their reinvestigation of the case. And then other kinds of discovery. But she so far hasn't gotten any discovery at all in this. You know, one of the great mitigating factors could be the fact that Brian's innocent. That's a great mitigating factor. You know, Becker will say, this is not a retrial. This is a resentencing. This man is guilty. Just give him a different sentence. And then Cindy on her side will say, this man, here's the mitigating things. His, you know, his age and blah, blah, blah. And she would like to say, and I can make quite a case that he's innocent. But whether that'll be allowed, I don't know.
Is it the same judge that's been presiding over this case since the beginning?
Yeah, Guyton. He still is, even though he's on senior status now.
Should he recuse himself?
He couldn't get switched out unless he switched himself out. I couldn't, and nobody else could tell you what Judge Guyton's thinking about. But he gives no sign of giving up the case.
Stay tuned for our final edition of the Firefighter Case, where Aaron and I will analyze a lot of the evidence and situations that you just heard. Thank you for listening.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.